Priveni dobro pozhalovat, my tavarishi. This is the Eurobureau of Literaturo, and joining us for this very, very special broadcast is the esteemed international man of mystery himself, Professor Alexander Dugin. Thank you for joining us today, Professor. How are you feeling? How are you doing?
Thank you for inviting me. Everything is quite right. We are all in waiting the result of American elections that will change decisively the world, and I hope we can speak about that. So in this eschatological time, I think everything is going very well. Everything is going according to the plan, and that inspires very, very great expectations.
Without a doubt. So a quick note to the audience, we are accepting chats through Entropy. We just ask that you honor and respect the professor's time. Do not send anything that is not a serious question or comment that you would like to have addressed by either Professor Dugin or the rest of the panel. So if you want to crack wise, please do that in the chat, but anything that you would like our attention for, just please give the respect that is deserved. So with that being said, let's just get right into the first question. Professor Dugin, you have a particular reputation in the West. You are considered a heretic, we could say, across the political spectrum. Could you comment on your works, how they've been received by the West, and maybe even more broadly, your relationship to Western liberalism, the direction you would like it to take, were it to be receptive to your ideas?
So, first of all, I could recognize myself as absolute enemy of liberalism. So I am illiberal, anti-liberal. I reject and refuse anything liberal. So I think that the liberalism is false, is wrong, totally. That is mistake, that crime and error, not only in the applications or in perversions of its initial principles, but as such. So liberalism is wrong from very beginning. And all the roots of liberal philosophy, liberal economy, liberal understanding of a human being, liberal ontology, liberal gnosiology, all that is wrong. It is the result of the nominalist approach. So that everything began with Occam and nominalism in the Middle Ages. They were, in the Middle Ages, considered heretics. But little by little, their individualism, they refused to accept the reality of the ideas, of the universals, of the something that is purely spiritual, and their concentration on exclusive reality of the individual things, that was beginning of the anti-world, anti-culture, anti-philosophy of the modern natural science, modern atomism, modern democratic vision of the politics, and all that was wrong and is wrong. And the error was precisely in nominalism. And liberalism, as the most consequent result or conclusion from nominalism, because liberalism put only individual as the human being. So individuality is the only reality. Everything that is collective identity, artificial or natural, is totally destroyed. So liberation of this individual core from all links of collective identities, natural or historical, cultural, institutional, and so on, is the main goal of liberalism. So I refuse everything from that. I refuse nominalism. I refuse liberalism. I refuse modernity. I refuse modern natural science. I think it's totally wrong. I refuse modern political, cultural, and social dogmas. All of them are based on liberalism. So that is why I am considered to be heretic. So I am heretic and I recognize in front of liberal paradigm. In that sense, yes, I belong to the Middle Ages, I belong to the Christianity, I belong to the Platonism, to Aristotle vision of the things. I strongly believe in God, in transcendence, in verticality, in faith, in moral, in ethics, in hierarchy. So could you imagine something that could less fit to the norms and rules and principles of modern liberal globalist attitudes in epistemology, in philosophy, in science, in political correctness? So I'm radically against all that. So that is only logical that I am rejected by this liberal system. But I think, generally speaking, the reception of my ideas in the West, as in the East, is very well. So I didn't expect such sincere, honest, and open interest for that. So including the enemies who pursue me, liberals, they pay a kind of some tribute to the danger that represent my ideas, my position. They consider me to be most dangerous philosopher in the world. It is partly joke, but partly they do accordingly. So they cancel my YouTube account, my Google poll email, they don't sell my books in Amazon. Recently, they have canceled my Twitter. So they act accordingly. I am all the sanctions of Canada, of United States, of America, only for my ideas. So they consider my idea to be inacceptable, heretic in that sense. But there are so many heretics in the West. So, and they, normally, they are all my friends, almost all. So they recognize in my radical criticism of liberalism, not from only from the right, but from the left. I'm anti-liberal in all the senses. I advocate everything outside of liberalism. So left, right, Eastern, Western, everything that is not contemporary liberal globalist dominant ideology. So that makes the field of my friends or allies or people just interested very broad and very large. And I think that reception of the West and radical rejection, a persecution of my ideas, words, texts, articles, speeches by the dominant system is a kind of appraisal. It is a kind of compliment. It's something that reconforts me in my struggle, because the much worse would be totally unknown, totally marginalized, or totally ignored. So I think that I'm considered one of most radical heretic in front of the liberalism. That is a kind of merit, that is a kind of recognition of my work, and I think that I enjoy the growing audience from all kind of dissidents, all kind of dissenters from different part of societies in the West. So despite of this prohibitions, interdictions, all kind of obstacle to get access to my thoughts, my ideas still can enter in the Western society, and communication is just growing all with all new attack. With every new attack, each new attack, they provoke more interest, I think. So that's more or less about exception or perception of my ideas in the West.
Well, that was a very strong breakdown. I also really appreciated the points you made about the roots of liberalism within medieval heresy and nominalism. I think that's something very understated a lot of the times in academic departments here in the West. So I do really like to hear that. Now, I want to turn my first question to you specifically on the artificial separation today between politics and philosophy. Often those that are engaged in politics, they see philosophy as as unpragmatic or dealing with too many abstractions and ignoring the real games of power in the political arena. And on the other side, philosophy is very fragmented into specializations. So you have like philosophy of religion, philosophy of mind, political philosophy. And to a sense that does reflect a greater degree of applied insight that does produce a certain specialization. But on the other side, it reflects a split that we get with modernity, and that is that religion is relegated to something private and interior against the secular public sphere, or politics or the economy has its own sphere, like something Foucault would call veridiction, right? And so anyone can see that if you follow the implications of philosophy, you can see that these spheres are not separate at all, even though philosophy can operate independently. And you talk about Schmitt and his idea of four concepts in your explanation of the philosophy of politics. And then you talk about the importance of Plato in this regard and how we owe this all to Plato. So for the sake of the audience, would you elaborate for the audience on your conception of the philosophy of politics and then with that, the importance of Plato?
So I think that philosophy, it is not just the profession or one of possible occupation or vocation or of the human life. The philosophy is the core of the human being. So the philosopher is the human, it is the man or woman. So to be philosopher, it is the same as to be the man. And when they try to eradicate philosophy or separate the philosophy from politics, philosophy from culture, from art, from everything, from economy, they try to cut the roots of the human being, because our being, we are very, very, very similar to the other species in everything except the mind. Our possibility to think, to make philosophy, to live philosophically, it is our distinction as human being. All other things we share with the other species of the world. The only thing that is properly human, it is the thought, and the philosopher are those who think, not who occupy some cathedra, some chair in some institution. It is not institution. Philosophy, it is not about institution. It is about being human. And if you attack the philosophical dignity of the man, if you try to reduce or to prohibit or to limit the capacity to think about being, about our being ourselves or other, so you finally, that is anti-human, because you try to prohibit to the man to access to himself, to his inner self, to foundation, to the principle of existence, and the problem, as Heidegger would say, the problem of being, because our thought is the relation to being, and everything depends from that. So I have written some books on philosophy of politics, and for me, as for Heidegger, philosophy and politics are just the same. Just the same, they are not two branches or two disciplines. For example, the main frame of Plato's teaching was expressed and in the state, in the Republic, in the book that was dedicated to the political structure. So that is not the chance. So the core of Platonic philosophy was absolutely embedded in his thought about the state, because the state is the order, the cosmos is order, the human thought is order. The philosophy is about this inner ontological and theological order. So it is all about order. And if we try to separate the philosophy from politics, or we destroy the very fundamental aspect and essence of the order. We are destroying the order. When they say that they want to liberate human from philosophy, human being, they lie, liberals lie, because they want to impose their own philosophy. They want to impose their own metaphysics that is nihilistic, that destroys any kind of ontology except the ontology basing on the individualism. But very interesting, when they cut the roots with the main ontological structure, when they deny the possibility or necessity to put the human being, human individual, in the broader ontological and philosophical context, they destroy the human core of the man, because individualism in the liberal concept is something, it's being totally separated from any kind of essential natural relation to anything that transcends an individual. So to the nation, to class, to the culture, to the people, to the ideas, to the spirit, to God, finally. So, and when we liberate the human being, human individual, basing on this nominalist approach from everything, including from the philosophy, the humanity disappears. And that is what is precisely the moment, philosophical essence of the moment we are living in. Now we are on the limit, on the border between still human society, but already liberal. It is already semi-human. It's half-human society. Liberalism, it is anti-humanism. It is absolutely anti-human. But now, following this liberal agenda, liberating individual from all the kind of relations, we are coming to the singularity moment when the humanity will give its leading role in the life to the post-human species, to the artificial intelligence, to the cyborgs, to all kind of non-human entities. And that will be the end of individual as well as human individual. Because to be human, that means to belong to some collective identity. Today, they are destroying the gender identity. That is as well collective identity. They have destroyed political collective identity, destroying communism, fascism, Middle Age estate concept of the human and religious understanding, religious anthropology. And now they almost have destroyed the sex as the kind of two group of the humanity. And the last thing, the last point the liberals are going to destroy, it is belongingness, the fact to belong to the human ontology. And that is precisely what is the reason why they prohibit to us the philosophy, because philosophy is quite opposite. And above all, the Platonic or Aristotelian philosophy, I clearly see the difference between Plato and Aristotle, but both of them, very important, both of them are excluded from liberal point of view. If we read attentively Karl Popper's Open Society and Its Enemies, we see that is radical criticism not only of Plato, but as well of Aristotle, because Aristotle is realism, Platonism is idealism, but nominalism, that is its basis for liberalism, is nominalism is quite different. It refuses any kind of being recognized by some spiritual aspect of the reality. Reality is only individual thing, and that is the basis as well for natural science. And that is why the modern natural science is absolutely wrong from the very beginning to the end. And the problems that modern, more honest and sincere scientists are encountering now, the roots and the reasons of them, we should search in the beginning of the modernity. Modernity was created and built on the lie, the big atomistic nominalist line. And oblivion of Aristotle and the Plato was the reason. So that was abandoning of the real philosophy, of the richness, of the plurality of the real philosophy in favor of something sub-philosophical, and I consider nominalism as sub-philosophy, as a kind of, and all the modernity, everything that is modern in philosophy is somehow sub-philosophical. It is farther and farther from the real core of the soul. Only there are some exceptions, as conservative revolutionary efforts to restore, to return to the roots in a difficult situation and a radical situation, as for example in the case of Heidegger. But in general, current of history of modern philosophy is progressing in oblivion of the being, abandoning of the being, of the real philosophical capacity to think. So we are losing capacity to think, and liberal are pushing us more and more in this direction, and they are happy with that. They are happy in this dehumanization, with this dehumanization of the human society, and that is why I think we could not fight against them without defending the full-scale philosophical identity. Our struggle is first of all philosophical.
That's very well said. Professor Dugin, you characterize the fundamental basis of political antagonism in terms of the one and the many, a la Plato and traditionalism on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the many and the one. You mentioned Karl Popper before. In your book, Political Platonism, you refer to Democritus, but you also talk about modernity and liberalism. How can modernity and liberalism overcome this problem? How do we move from a policy?
I agree totally with Neoplatonic vision of and reading of Parmenides' dialogue of Plato, that only that exists in the reality that recognizes the priority and dominance of the one. So, but the one, the unity, is apophatic, is transcendental things. We could not find in the being the unity. The unity is transcendental to being. So the unity is just the horizon, something that is being outside all the limits, all the borders. It's a pure transcendence. That is the unity. And this unity is very rich and very good in itself. It gives the multiplicity as the result of its goodness. And that is how reality is created from something that precedes being. And that of all the five hypotheses of Parmenides, of the dialogue of Parmenides of Plato, are dedicated to that. So if we recognize unity, we are inside of the reality. And if we start with the many, with multitude, as Spinoza, for example, or postmodernist, of modern leftist, or postmodern epistemology, we already are outside of the reality, we are in the virtuality, in the cyberspace of the lie. So that is a simulacrum of the reality. So everything that is created from many to one. So in order to make it possible, the multiplicity or many should exist, but they are not. They don't exist. They're the main principle, not only of Platonism, but of the philosophy of Aristotle, of all traditional epistemology, agnosiology, except epistemology, agnosiology of the Western modernity, this damned Western modernity, all other kind don't recognize the reality of many. Many is a kind of limit of the one. So when the unity, when the one is going outside of itself, outside, and this journey, this trip, this travel to this exile of itself, of the one, can arrive to the limit when the return begins. That is the many, that is the matter, that is the point of return. And we could not create anything from these absolutely pervasive nihil, nothing. So it is not the reality, it's the limit of the exile and the point of conversion of the return. It is not the ontological basis. It is the meeting with nothing that pushes us to return to our roots. That is many. That it, we could not create on that nothing, only just return. And when we have philosophy basing on recognition of the reality of atomic particles, of the smallest this many that doesn't exist, and this smallest point doesn't exist in the reality, modern physics shows us that is absolutely false hypothesis that subatomic level and lesser realities appear when we concentrate ourselves more and more. There is no atom. Atom is completely wrong idea, and we could create the reality from many. Because the many, the concept of pola in Greek, many, multiplicity, it is something that doesn't exist at all. It is just direction of the distance from the unity. It is direction to go into exile. But exilic being, it is the being of someone who is in exile and not exile itself. We could not create ontology of exile, destroying that who is put in this kind of proof and this radical condition. So we could not create nothing on the concept of many without unity, without one. So we are living outside of the reality. The modern reality, modern realism is absolutely false. It is a kind of simulacrum. We are in matrix in somehow. Matrix created by architects of the modernity. That was a kind of magic, but not traditional magic, but reverse the satanic magic of modernity that inspired to us the absolutely wrong, irrealistic vision of what is and what is not. So everything that is based on the plurality and not on unity, everything doesn't exist when it is based on the many and don't proceed from the unity. So that is a main point. So democracy can be accepted when there is the kind of unity in democracy, when there is some leading idea in the small society, in the villages, for the peasants, democracy or self-rule of small collective, quite possible, because there is unity. That is not composed, that is organic unity with the roots, with the tradition. But when we apply the same principle of people ruling themselves in the organic collective to the huge amount of the people that don't know each other, that have nothing in common, we are destroying and perverting everything. So it is not anymore democracy. It is totalitarian imposition. It is radical racist concept of modern liberal democracy that destroys any kind of real self-rule. That is a kind of they steal the possibility to influence the destiny, to decide for themselves. Finally, they destroy the human dignity of the societies. They pretend not to rule, but they rule pretending not to rule them more radically. They try to get to portray it in our minds to say you shouldn't permit yourself non-political correctness thoughts, including you should not put the like on the picture or the articles or the words you like, because you just shouldn't. So that is modern liberal democracy. It is absolutely totalitarian. It is, there is nothing democratic, for example, in Athenian Greek sense. I am not against democracy. I'm against everything that is not based on the unity. And there is organic collective unity of the village, of the small state, basing on the unity of the traditions, of the culture, where the multiplicity is included and not excluded from this unity. And that is not nothing totalitarian. Hannah Arendt has said once, totalitarianism is a modern phenomenon. It is not about Middle Ages. It is not about traditional society. So the totalitarianism is modernity, and liberalism that seemed earlier less totalitarian than communism and fascism, and maybe it was so, but now when there is no more neither fascism nor communism, we see the same modern totalitarian nature of liberalism itself. So we are living outside of the real organic democracy, democracy as participation of the people in its destiny. And that it would be great to have such kind of democracy. But the main condition to create the real substantial political order is the unity. Outside of the unity, nothing.
Thank you for the very insightful answer. And I do want to get back actually to your critiques of the second and third position a bit later on. But there is an interesting passage that stuck out to me in Political Platonism. It's on the 11th proposition of part one of the ontological basis of Political Platonism. And that's when you criticize the will to power and you talk about power in the Platonic sense as truth, as sacral, ideal, rational, and clear. And you also give a bit of account of time as well, like in the sense that secular modernist accounts of time tend to be very fixed and spatialized, while the Platonic and then certainly the Christian idea of time occurs in a more along the ways of the idea of truth itself, in the sense that it's vertical and it's kairos or apocalyptic or apocalypse's time as opposed to the time of chronos. And then you say that truth is like lightning in the sense that it's like an event, that this is the event. And so what stuck out to me is there's a lot of philosophies of the event right now. You have Heidegger's, you have Derrida's, Deleuze's. And the other one which speaks out to me is Alain Badiou's, who has an ontology almost separately to you on the sense that his ontology is an ontology of the multiple over the one. And in a way, what I'm interested then is, what is your account of the philosophy of the event for you?
For me, I have started with the concept of Heidegger and Ereignis as a kind of the final moment of the history of the philosophy, when Dasein, the human being here, understand the reason of the oblivion of the being as a kind of special message of being itself. So that is somehow the God is dead because he wants us to experience his death as our inner experience, as our inner being. So it is not the humans with proud and titanic spirit. They have won over God in the modern atheistic secular reality. God wanted to be dead, and that is a very Christian idea. And we need, as Apostle Paul has said, we are baptized in the death of the Christ, in the death. So event for me, or Ereignis, it is understanding of the darkness of the dark age. Why darkness? So why there is the darkness? Why there are we? Who are not the darkness, but who are in the absolute darkness, not being the darkness. And to understand the reason for that, that will be the end of the darkness. That will be new dawn. That will be the moment of new dawn, or a kind of revelation, apocalyptic revelation. Why we have reached such deepest point of the midnight. So Heidegger has written many things about the midnight, cosmic midnight, of historical midnight. We are just in the midnight, but always there is maybe not now, maybe a bit later. The decision about have we already reached the midnight or still not, that is a kind of event. That is event when we with absolute confidence would say yes, that is the midnight, that will be beginning of the new dawn, beginning of the morning, beginning of the light. And the light that will appear, it will be our inner light, not outer light, our light that we manifest in the heart of the darkness. That is event, and that coincides as a form, as philosophical structure, with many different traditional vision of the history. And first of all, with Iranian, Zoroastrian, Mazdain history, as the fight between the darkness and the light. And when the light at the end of this fight seems to fail, to be totally overcome, to be totally defeated by the darkness, in that moment that will appear a kind of beam of light from the residues of the army of light, who will still be loyal to the end, to the principle. And that is Zoroastrian vision of the linear time, but an event that is appearance or manifestation of the savior, of the Saoxian. In Christianity, we have almost the same, strictly the same vision, and in many other historical concepts, including sometimes in the secular forms, in the German classical philosophy, we see this end of the history as event, as a very important metaphysical event that arrives not outside of us, but from inside of us, in the very critical, in the most critical moment of the history of the beings, Seinsgeschichte, as Heidegger said. So Seinsgeschichte culminates in the moment when, in the full and absolute darkness, there will be the light, not from outside, but from inside of this darkness. And that will the sign that darkness, with all its amount of global ontological power, could do nothing, absolutely nothing to the real light. That is event. And Christianity thinks that there will be no need to the new golden age, because in that moment of this final proof, there will be everything. Everything will be saved. Everything will be transfigured and transformed. And that is the moment of the second arrival of the Christ, but not somehow or not non-related to us, very closely related to our decision. But we will need anymore the new golden age, because if we understand what is the reason, what is the real essence of dark age, of Kali Yuga, of apocalyptical rule of Antichrist, if we can understand why, if we understand the real reason and real nature of this final proof, there will be nothing to explore anymore. So we will the kind of the mission of the creation will be fulfilled, and that is Christian more radical understanding of the event. There are the other more relative versions. So that's moment of the appearance of the light in the midnight will be the beginning of the new golden age, new Satya Yuga, and the Hindu cyclic doctrine or something like that. But I think the Christianity gives the more radical answer for event. So event, it's that is the end of the history, but not as the catastrophe, but as a spiritual phenomenon, manifestation and revelation of highest importance. That is maybe more important than moment of the creation of the being. So the end of the being is somehow more important than the beginning. And those who are living at this moment have the great honor and great burden to decide for the destiny. So that is the idea, the thought about the Ragnis, about the event, was so heavy for Heidegger that he was totally overwhelmed. He was struck. He was turn apart by this idea of the event. I think that that is idea of ideas. And that is, we could not just reduce it to Platonism, because in the Platonic or Aristotelian vision, there is no time. That is paradise. The Plato or Aristotle is the condition of paradise, but we are in the history. We are in exile. We are outside of paradise. So, that and being outside, being in exile from this the garden of Plato or the garden of Aristotle, of academia or Lysi, we are outside of that, and the only hope for us to get to the real border, the end of the night, in order to accomplish or to participate in the great restoration.
So I think you've kind of addressed this. I'll ask it anyway. Especially in political Platonism, you talk a lot about anti-universalism. Your anti-universalism, I think, as it relates to modernity and liberalism. My question for you, Professor Dugan: where is the middle ground or the cohesion between your anti-universalist views and your view of Platonism?
So, I don't deny the unity, but I insist on the apophatic, so pre-ontological nature of being, as a Neoplatonist, as a follower of Plotinus or Proclus. I think that unity is above being. So we could, that is why nobody can pretend to know this unity. We could only strive to it. We should be absolutely in the relation to this unity, but this relation is relation to the unity. So we could be more and more close to each other, more and more universalist, when we try to get to the core or the main fundament principle of our own position or tradition or our perspective. So when we coming to the center of the circle, we are closer to it. But nobody not reaching this center could pretend, oh, I know the unity. Unity is something that transcends our possibility to have. That unity can have us, and we cannot have unity. So I am not against universalism. I am for the real universality that we can reach only coming to the core of our particular position and perspective in the world. So if we put together elements of one tradition, of one culture, or one society, and pretend that is the unity, it is something quite opposite to the unity. It is artificial totalitarian construction that destroys any possibility to get to the unity. That in order to get to the unity, we need come to the roots of our particular religion or tradition. Inside and not outside of this tradition, we could hope to have the unity. But I would like to say something more. In Nietzsche, Zarathustra, there was the question how the gods, in plural, laughed at one of them who pretended to be one and lonely. And Heidegger once said, let us to decide whether there is one God or there is no such structure to the gods themselves. We are too humble, we are too small in order to pretend to know this unity. So we should be put in our normal dimensions, in limits. Let us hope on this unity. Let us strive to this unity. Let us search this unity, basing on our concrete position in the spiritual ground, in Christianity, in Islam, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in all possible spiritual sacred tradition. We could hope or expect to get closer to this unity. But who pretends, oh, I know there is unity. So he just replaced, but his own relative unity, the universal unity, that is not universality when you pretend that your particular relative position is universal. In order to get to real and true universality, we need somehow ask all the forms of human life or philosophies. That is why I have written 24 volumes of Noumachia, trying to describe different civilization: African, Latin American, ancient, modern, American, North American, Latin American, Chinese, Malayan, and many other. All that I could get, at least in some with some amount of attention given to them, in order to show that when we say, oh, the human is, oh, the love is, oh, the death is, we just use the concepts from our own culture, and we have no we don't imagine normally that, for example, in different tribes, in different cultures, in different civilization, the same or similar words mean totally different meanings. And in order to understand what Chinese understand by death or by life, we need to learn their culture, relations between the concept or the form of being, the rights, the historical experience, social modes, including small tribe of Amazonian forest, as well have their own cosmology, their own cosmos, and their own nature. So I am, in that sense, I'm in favor of the pluralism, not only of cultures, but pluralism of natures. So and that is important. So that is the plurality of the cosmological, natural phenomenon. It is the very important aspect. So there is not only one world, there are many worlds, and each to each civilization, to each culture belong its own world. And real universality could be received or only after going to the core of all of them. And that is why for the Greeks to travel, to make trips in the Mediterranean or the Eastern society to the Egypt was so important before starting philosophy, because they should understand, they should have knowledge about what the Egyptians think, what Iranians, Persians think, what the other tribes and cultures. Only putting together this richness, this multiplicity of the worlds, we could hope maybe once to arrive to this universality, but it should be problematic. So I'm the real Platonism is open Platonism, in my opinion. That is apophatic Platonism, with the first hypothesis of the dialogue Parmenides of Plato, which every Platonist should start with this first hypothesis. After that, all Neoplatonism will be totally clear, and everything in apophatic theology of Christianity and philosophy of Hegel, with this first hypothesis, we get access, the key to the real philosophy.
Thank you very much. This is very insightful, and there's actually a lot about theological questions I want to talk with you about, but I mean, for the sake of time, I'll jump ahead and skip a few. Maybe we can do this another time. So what I'll just jump to instead is to talk about how the construction of your fourth political theory is very much a Heideggerian project. And there's a focus on the concept of phenomenological destruction of the Cartesian subject, whether that be the individual for liberalism, class for communism, or the nation state for fascism. And that these three things, subjects, are distorted and alienated existentials of Dasein, and then they're reworked and made concrete by Das Man. And so I agree with your project of engaging in phenomenological destruction of these subjects of modernity, which is actually largely what we do on this channel. But for the audience and in your work, how would you subject the other twin subjects of modernity, that is class and nation state, to phenomenological destruction? Because as we find in Being and Time, Heidegger does a very good job of destructing the Cartesian subject. But in your case, how do you engage in your project to discover the
vote? So first of all, I think that the explanation of the fourth political theory, we could follow two paths, two ways. First of all, the philosophical way, and when we deconstruct or distract, according to Heidegger, modern subject, Cartesian subject, and apply three avatars, three forms of it to individual as one kind of subject, class, a subject in Marxism, or nation, a political subject for third political theory, destroying or deconstructing them, we are dealing with nothing, nothing modern at least. And Heidegger calls this nothing as the kind of ground for human political or philosophical thought, a kind of territory, the space, the earth for that, zero level of the thought, Dasein. So Dasein to be here, and that should replace this superstructures of the Cartesian subject, and for the philosophers, that is enough, because if you apply this invitation to develop existential approach of Heidegger, put Dasein, for example, in all possible political context, Dasein and the political power, Dasein and democracy, Dasein and law, Dasein and state, Dasein and social justice, and so on and so on, you will almost automatically receive some existential answers. So there is no world, there is being in the world, there is no other, there is Mitzvah, being quiz, and working with this existential concept, you can easily, being philosopher, in accordance with my invitation to develop this fourth political theory, you could construct the model of this existential politics. It's enough to say that we destroy three classical subject of liberalism, communism, and fascism, and national socialism, and we install fourth subject, Dasein Heidegger, because it is not void affirmation. It is based on the 100 volumes of Heideggerian works. It is difficult but very passionate work. But there is the second way. If some, for example, we are speaking with not philosopher, we could indicate the other way. For example, individual, class, and nation, all of them are concepts that are more or less artificial and materialistic. And there is the other concept, that is people, folk, ein Volk in German, Narod in Russia, that is something that is missing link in all these three political theory. The people that is the basis of our constitutions. And the people is ignored, is perverted, is replaced or by some of individuals or by class or by political citizens, as the nation is. Individual political citizens, they are formed artificially by bourgeois state, finally. So, and with bourgeois relations. All these artificial creations of modernity, they ignore, refuse, and destroy the people. And the people is something that exists in spite of individuals, of the class, of the nations. The people, it is organic unity of the history, organic community. And this organic community, the people can be the same as design for the easier way to explain first political theory. So we need to restore the people in the center, not the people interpreted as the summary of individuals, because that is not the people, not as political citizenship, because if you are you have the citizenship of France, you should be French, but you could be French, you could belong to the people. That is not about race, not about ethnic, that is about identity. So you can be integrated in the identity of the people. The people is always open, but it as well very demanding. To be the part of the people, you should, you are obliged to share with these people its values, its history, its will, its sins, and its goodwill. So the good and the better and the best and the worst are included in the people. It is not abstraction. It is organic life of collective identity, but collective, not collected, but general identity. It is kind of organic unity. That is the people. And the people is missing in all political version of the modernity. To idea how realize fourth political theory, we need remember the people and put in the center of everything. So that, but the people not as race, neither as race, nor as ethnic groups, nor as purely artificial social creations. So the people is defined by the relation to values, to the ground, and to the death. Because that is not only the way of life, but it is a way to understand the meaning and the ontology of the death that makes the people itself. And there is very important Spanish poet Lorca, Garcia Lorca, who has said that, for example, Spanish people, according to Lorca, is very particular because he begins to live when being dead. So that is a theater of the death that is the first time when the people come out of its interiority. So that very interesting idea. So when we search what is the people, it is mystical universe. It is not something that we could measure by rational standards. That is the people is the universe. It is universality in itself, not only language but language as well. This structuralists, they have shown that the language is the world. So to know the language, it means to know the world, because without the names, the things of the world cannot exist. So first political theory is based, is constructed, is built around or on the ground of design for the philosopher, on the ground of the people for the less philosopher. But we could not imagine the people totally not philosophical being. That is impossible. That would be idiot, just idiot. But what is the use to speak with idiots? So let us speak with philosopher, more philosopher, less philosopher, as a Platonist used to say. There is no evil. There is less of the good. So that is small part of the good. Evil has no ontology. So stupidity has no ontology. It is just the small amount of wisdom. So let us speak with wise people with different proportions of wisdom, and let hope that wisdom will grow in each of them.
That's very well said. I have one last question for you, Professor Dugan, and then we can turn to super chats if you would oblige us. In the final part of Political Platonism, you talk a lot about your theory of chaos. I think at one point you describe the Russian people as being more a people of chaos. In your view, is within the work of Heidegger, you trace the failure of Western philosophy back to the exclusion of chaos. Can you elaborate the meaning of this concept for a new beginning? How might we include chaos as to revitalize philosophy? And would that include
first of all, I think that chaos is the void, the first meaning of the word, Greek word, that was the void between void, empty space, emptiness between the heaven and earth, and there was the this emptiness, this void was filled with the eros. Or something that is in the middle, or that is a kind of, or first man, first spiritual man on Eros or angel that appeared in the center or between earth the heaven. Interesting that the word gas we are using, it is Dutch word for chaos. Oh, gas is chaos. It's Van Helmont, Dutch alchemist, has introduced that concept. That is in Dutch. That means just chaos, and as well the air. So the air, it is something that is between earth and the heaven. So that is original meaning of the chaos. So it is nothing too terrible. So the real order and the real structure should include this void and not exclude it. So it should be constructed basing on the concrete operation with this void. So it is not kind of exclusion. If we could create everything only on the principle of the heaven, of the order, of the transcendence, that will be abstract, that will without existence, that could have been, but it will not have the life. And the life is from the earth, and in the chaos they meet with that is the Heidegger's concept of Gefährt. So when the heaven and the earth meet with each other, that is the point where the chaos lives, and the chaos gives the life to the thought, and the thought gives the sense to the life. So the meeting point is extremely important. And Nietzsche used to say, only those who bear in their souls the chaos, they could give birth to the dancing star. So that doesn't mean that we should copy the Middle Ages texts or return to some scholastic concept in order return to the sacredness is not to repeat but to give birth. It is to give life, and life it is not easy thing. It is not just imitation or of the eternal truths. It is a kind of dramatic effort to give birth to life. So my idea that we should not only overcome the present darkness, but we should interact with this darkness. We should transform confusion of modern confusion into creative chaos, going outside of its negative, of the transcending negative results of our history, but resurrecting positive results. There are hidden these results in the hidden and the secret way. They are inside of this, in this point of midnight. So this chaos is not chaos in the as the same as confusion. Confusion is not chaos. It is a result of this destruction. So the fragmentation, and chaos is organic. It is very, very holistic in some way. So the chaos is the first matter for the alchemists to create golden the alchemical gold of immortality.
All right, very informative answer. Now I think that'll wrap up our discussion portion. And I think now it's time to get to the audience questions. Now, are you good for about 25 minutes to go through them? Because I think people sent quite a bit of them. And we might have to, maybe if you're welcome to come back, we can get to the rest we didn't get to on another time, because a lot of people want to hear from you. So are you good for about 25 minutes?
Yes, please.
All right, so I'll get right into it. First one. This one comes from Billy, and he says, what do you think of American fascists like Francis Parker Yockey, who worked with the USSR and the Third World to support socialist and Islamist revolutions as a means to weaken American capitalist empire? Do you support a united proletariat struggle to fight the American empire, known as one struggle?
So, first of all, my first political theory is based on the critical approach to all three political theories. For the liberalism, I see nothing positive on liberalism, with one exception. I think that today, liberalism, who advocates individual, is in very awkward position, because now, following liberalism, we have arrived to the point where there is no more individual. So there is dividual. This is a fragmentation of individuals. So the triumph and the victory of liberals is very ephemeric. It's very, very, that is illusion. Because when individual is finally achieved, he should be destroyed. And now we could as well advocating everything that was less modern. We could in some aspect to be with some old liberals that still believed sincerely in the individual freedom. They were wrong, but finally they were not so wrong as the modern liberal, neoliberal, that totally monsters. I criticize second political theory, Marxism, because of atheism, materialism, but I think the rejection of capitalism was good in the second political theory, and that was right point. That's and collective identity, in spite of being artificial, it's better than no collective identity at all in liberalism. So I could advocate some parts. In a third political theory, I advocate as well, and Yockey is the one of representative of the third political theory. He advocated the rejection of the individualism. He was anti-liberal, and that is at least something. He was anti-communism, that is good, but he was as well racist, and he praised national state that was somehow a bourgeois concept. So I'm much more in favor of Julius Evola. So I prefer an absolutely profound Julius Evola, who was temporarily as well sided with third political theory, but his ideas are much fit much more to the fourth political theory, because basing on his on his criticism of all what is Western modernity, following René Guénon. At the same time, Evola advocated the kind of fascism, kind of racism, but he gave to that purely spiritual interpretation. But this aspect is less sympathetic for me, because I am decisively anti-racist, because I don't believe in any possibility of existence of the hierarchy between the people, because they are universes or species. We could not establish hierarchy between the crow and squirrel, for example. Because one entity could fly, the other not, but that doesn't say anything about their mutual position on the hierarchy ladder of the beings. The same with the people. The people are totally different. They are worse, but we could not compare them instead of establishing some point of higher and lesser value. So I reject that, and that is response or answer for everything that is linked to the third political theory. And finally, and once more, in that point, I agree with Evola. I am against national state, because national state is the bourgeois creation. Today, when the liberals want to destroy totally national state, we could, by pragmatic reason, side with that, as we could side with, for example, with old liberals having at least individual dignity or real understanding of the human freedom, because neoliberals, they refuse any kind of freedom. They have lost totally any kind of understanding of freedom, because they just try to impose their agenda as something universal. It is pure totalitarianism. But so we could as well defend communism, side with communism, because the communism is in favor of social justice, and liberalism destroys social justice. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we could or should accept Adam Smith, Yorke, or Marx. So we could read all of them, we could compare, and I am totally against any kind of prohibition. We could read and study and think about everything we want. We could read liberal authors and study, learn them, and search in them as well, in communism and the fascism and the racism. We could agree or not. First political theory doesn't agree with racism, national state, and for example, I think that Evola is much more important than all authors of the third rate. He is much today. He is much more actual, and but he is as well demonized. He is put under under censorship. But defend Evola is much more productive, I think, than defend Yorke. We could read Yorke, but I think American revival and American conservative revolution demands new philosopher. So we could not just be satisfied with what we have. We absolutely need some American mind, real American conservative or traditionalist mind, because finally, American identity, I have dedicated to American identity one of volume of my Noomachia. I think that is pragmatism. So that is pragmatism in the positive sense. It is not only negative side, as utilitarian, practical, but pragmatism, it is well the big freedom of the subject and the object. That is why some pragmatists are attracted by Heidegger. So I think that you need to find the key to interpret correctly in the conservative revolutionary way American mind. And I didn't find that in Yorke. It's just continuation of the third political theory of the European thinker. So I would prefer originally American version of alternative, including maybe far or far right or maybe radically conservative traditionalist vision. That will be very original, I am absolutely sure. And maybe I have missed something, but it seems to me that this kind of political thought was not too much developed in the United States. That is pity. When I have seen Bannon for the first time, I hope that maybe he will fill the gap, but I don't think so. That's an interesting phenomenon. At least Americans begin to read Ebola or Genon or Gurdji. That's a very good sign, but it's still not enough. So I expect apparition or manifestation of the real American thinker that will replace the authors, a kind of obsolete like Yockey.
Awesome answer. And I think actually the modernist construction of the nation state that you critique is something that we often take for granted, at least as distance in the West, is that tends to be unchallenged, and that basis tends to be overlooked and the critique very misunderstood. So I appreciate you clarifying that one for the audience. And now for the next question from I am Andres for five. Thank you. He says, how likely is the balkanization of Russia after the death of Putin? Russia has historically been held together by strongmen and ethnic Russian majority, death of Putin and growing Muslim population.
So that is very, very difficult question because in the reality, modern Russia is held by the figure of Putin, who is a kind of compromise between totally corrupted and pro-Western liberal elite in economy, in administration, and the majority of patriotic population. Not only Russian population, but as well our minorities are very, very Eurasianist. They are very traditionalist. So Muslim population, it's not the main goal, main threat, because they are not, they didn't come from outside. They lived here with us for many hundreds years, and they are part of our society, and they are sometimes they are much more conservative than Russians. So I don't think that ethnic differences will be the real threat to Russian unity after the end of the Putin. It is clear that now we have main factor in Russia that holds together the whole country. It is Putin, I agree. And that is very problematic to imagine, to think what can arrive after his end. Nobody has the clear vision about that. That is very, it could be catastrophe, because Putin is not the system. Putin is not the political idea. Putin is not the other. He's just a man who at least in half of his brain hear clearly the voice of the people and follow some geopolitical line. So it is much better than Gorbachev, than Yeltsin. They were catastrophe. Putin is not political thinker. He didn't create the regime. He just improved many things that were totally, almost totally lost. So he is a savior, but without teaching. He has no heritage because the system is very, very fragile. In actuality. So there will be many threats and many risks and dangers after the end of the Putin. I could not imagine how we will deal with that. It is very critical. But nevertheless, the power of Putin is precisely two things. Power of Putin is the support of all the conservative initiatives of the president by the absolute majority of the people, that is homogeneous people, Russian and not Russian, our people is in favor of tradition, and against liberalism, against individualism, against gender politics, against swamp. So our people is mobilized against the swamp. So that is why Trump is so sympathetic for us, at least in the words, in the shape, and in his strong speeches. In Rushmore Mountain, for example, great speech, finally, historical speech, when he said that now that is far left the liberal fashion that we are dealing cancel culture. He denounced it, many things. So he and our people, the absolute majority of our people think likewise. And Putin is supported by this. And the second, Putin is following, not always, not totally orthodoxly, but Eurasian geopolitics. He tries to restore the sovereignty. He tries to not to let the globalist power to encircle and destroy Russia. So his geopolitics is correct. And his conservative politics is correct. And little by little, I think that army and the part of the people who are in the services, secret services, the army is more or less transformed during Putin's rule in order to continue that. But there is no man, no structure, no political party that could be responsible for that. Or maybe it is hidden. I don't know. Putin is very, very reserved, very special man. He don't want to say what he thinks really. But I would say that, in my opinion, that is the very dangerous void, despite of all that. Maybe there is some line that will grant continuation of his politics, but what is sure, our people will be not changed. He will not change in the future. He will stay the same. It's Russian people. It is very, always for patriotism, for some traditionalism, for some collective identity, organic collective identity. And minorities are not the problem. They could be provoked. They could be used. They could be supported an artificial way against by Soros, by colored revolution. But we see the same in the United States, the same scenario. So it is always possible. But I think that the absolute majority of our people will support something like Putin, something. Or if, for example, political leader wants to have the popularity, he should be conservative. He should be Eurasianist. He should be traditionalist. He should be anti-swamp, not anti-West, anti-swamp. And that is important because we like West, but not neo-liberal, aggressive, globalist, cancel culture West.
Also, I think we got time for one more question, and we have reached the time limit today. So the last one will be for today, because I hope we can do a follow-up. The audience is very appreciative of you, and you're always welcome and encouraged to come back. We like your insight very much. Very much. So this one comes from Morgan for three. Could you elaborate on your point about the epistemological problem of the information age, truth and fake news in the media? You mentioned this in your debate with Bernard Henry Levy, and he pivoted like a coward.
About epistemology, I think that informational society could be characterized or resumed by the formula that is society when everybody is informed about everything but don't understand anything. So to be informed about everything and not understand anything about all that, it is the main is a nature of informational society. So everything is open, but you have no possibility to interpretation. So facts are given, interpretation are hidden. So you are totally blind in the beautiful landscape. So please enjoy it, your freedom. So to have this landscape, but on one condition, don't open your eyes. So that is informational time, and that is modern informational system. So I think that, to say the truth, all news are fake news. All news, because there are not the neutral fact we are obliged to inform. When we're beginning to inform, to say something, to transmit something, we are making the big choice. The absolute majority of the facts we put aside as irrelevant. But what is the relevance of the informational act? That depends on our epistemology, precisely. So we make such choice what we say and what we don't say. And that makes any news fake news, because it is based on the choice. And the choice is based on gnosiology, and gnosiology is based on the ideas we had already before these facts came to being. So it is auto-centric, autonomous speech about the thing known. And that is precisely what makes the information fake news. The other things, the fake mean false news. So, but what is true and what is false? That is a philosophical question. If we don't put this philosophical question, what is truth and what is false, we are outside, we are in the fake news. So, and after that, there is the propaganda rules. Who cries louder? Who has more money, who has more power in order to oblige you to hear. So that is already, but that has nothing to do with truth or the fair falsity. That is about completely other level. So when they say globalists, the swamp has their news, and they call that the real news, because simply just because they choice of the facts, and everybody who challenge their position, they are called immediately producers of the fake news. There is an interesting example. After the victory of Trump, many journalists of CNN, of BBC, of main American, British media came to me asking one question with camera, with crew, with people around. Did Moscow has intervened in the American elections? I have always said yes. Camera immediately open. Everybody is eager to listen to, oh, Mr. Dugin, how it was. Can you give us some details? Yes, please. I know by personal information that some liberal oligarch have convinced Putin that Hillary Clinton will certainly win. And they have suggested to finance her campaign. After that, all the cameras are switching off. No, that was not the answer. So I have said what I know, what I knew, but that nobody cares. No, absolutely nobody cares about what you know, what is the fact, what is the position. There's only one position. Putin has supported and financed Trump, and that is not fake news. Everything else is false news. So they come to ask you about they already know. So that is not fake news. If it is liberal mass media, if you say something that doesn't fit in that is immediately fake news. I don't say that we say the truth. I don't pretend that only philosophers seriously putting this question, what is true and what is false, could somehow approach to get closer to this problem. But it is about philosophy, not about information. Philosophy, that is something completely other than newspaper. So a newspaper on television, it is necessary propaganda, false consciousness, false fake news. And our news, alternative news, have the same epistemological and ontological value as theirs, but they pretend to say something other than their opinion. They pretend to inform us about the fact. And when we try, fact is something made, and something pragmatic. Fact in Latin, it is something that we have done. So they have done, and they inform us about what they have done. That, and when we have done something, they say, oh no, that is not the fact, because it is you who have done, and not ourselves. This field of information, it is not about truth, simply not, but about others. So we should not fight with them pretending as paranoid people. Oh no, we know the truth, you lie. Yes, they lie. And everybody who is not searching the truth is somehow lying when he, at least when he or she looks too confident in himself or herself. So we are lying when we are certain what we are saying. We are closer to the truth when we are asking, when we are in a search, when we are not too much certain about that. We say when we are open, that we are closer to the truth. Not we are not in the truth, but we are closer to the truth when we are open. So to keep this openness, I think that is our dignity and our vocation as the human being, still human being.
Very powerful stuff, Professor Dugan. It was an absolute honor to be able to speak with you these last 90 minutes. We hope to do it again whenever you're available. Open invitation anytime.
Thank you.
You know, you're one of a handful of really genuinely interesting people in the world, and it was an honor. So to the audience, I know they enjoyed it as well. We will return next week with interventions, and then the following week we'll discuss Augustine's political writings. So thank you to everyone for joining us. Thank you to Professor Dugan. Tyler, thank you for orchestrating this. Stay human.
Take care, everyone.